Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Helen Garner is my guest today. She's released her first novel in 15 years. The novel is called The Spare Room, and it's about a woman called Helen, who is the main character, and a dear friend who comes to stay with her. Her friend, called Nicola, is dying of cancer, and she's come to Melbourne, to Helen's house, to undergo some seriously shonky therapy, which is only making her sicker. In the book, Helen, the narrator, owns up to feelings of great volcanic rage that exist alongside tender compassion and at the end complete exhaustion. And you can't help thinking as you read it, oh dear God, will I have to go through this one day? That is, if you haven't had to do it already. And like so many of Helen Garner's books, The Spare Room will spark a lot of discussion about how we care for the people we love and how you might live out your last days in this world, how you might want to do it. Helen Garner, good morning.
Hello.
Hello. You like to really, you know, knock the scab off something and get the whole country talking, don't you?
Well, yeah, sort of not my aim, but it works out that way. I'm happy about that.
Yeah, well, that's what all writers seek to do. And I feel a little weird talking to you because I read that in one sitting, that book, and I feel like I've just spent, you know, a couple of hours traipsing around your home. As a snooper almost, being sort of privy to the details of your house and what goes on there. There's a lot of domestic detail in there. Do you mind us going into your house like that? I don't suppose you can mind, can you?
Well, it's not. The house in the book isn't exactly the same as the house that I actually live in. But there are certain resemblances. For example, I do have some fridge magnets that are shaped like golden bees. And, yeah, I do live next door to my daughter and there's a gap in the fence and, you know, all those sorts of things.
It is a work of fiction, and it's not exactly you in the book. That's fair to say,
no,
that?
No. And even if it was memoir, you know, even if it were a memoir, which it's not, even that wouldn't be exactly me. I find it very interesting to think how a writer appears in a piece of literature. It's a very mysterious thing. And I think when people get upset and cranky wanting to know why, if you call this a novel, because it's obviously based on real experience, I say, well, a book exists on a spectrum between literal reality, which doesn't exist, and complete fantasized reality, which can't exist either. So every book that I've ever written is placed somewhere on that spectrum.
This one just happens to be a lot closer to the the reportage, I suppose.
Yeah,
you'd call it, wouldn't
well,
you?
It's swerved pretty close to real events, but there are whole tracts in it that are invented. And so by putting the word novel on the cover, my aim is to say to the reader, okay, don't get the idea that everything in this story actually really happened. It's not non-fiction, in other words. In fact, because it's the first fiction I've published since a book called Cosmo Cosmolino that came out in the 90s, people now think of me, I think there's a whole generation of people who have read my work who think of me as a non-fiction writer. So in a sense, it was necessary to, you know, advertise on the front that this is not non-fiction. But
why did you stay away so long from fiction?
I didn't do it on purpose. I've always thought of myself as a writer that was fairly close to the sort of real end of writing. And I've made a living over the years between books by doing journalism and that kind of reviewing and essay writing of a fairly personal kind.
So in a way, this isn't really a great divergence from what you've been doing over the last 15
years. No, it's not. No, it really isn't. But it is a divergence from what I've done over, you know, just the last two big books I've done, Joe Cinque and The First Stone. But even when I'm doing nonfiction, there's a large personal component in it.
So shifting it a little closer to the fiction end of things, does that allow you to, I don't know, do things like get a whole group of incidents and compress them into one? Mm. Allows you to do that?
Yes, it does, and it's really wonderful to get back to doing that. when you're writing nonfiction, you have got a leg rope on you. You have a contract with the reader, I believe, the contract that says, look, I'm not going to say something's true if it isn't true, and if I haven't been able to corroborate it in some way, I haven't made up anything that's in this book. But I would so love to be able to publish a book that didn't have to advertise its category.
Right.
I would love it if I could publish a book that just was a book and it was called So and So by Helen Garner, and people just picked it up and jumped into it without all their kind of categories clattering around their ears.
So to use it like a cute little domestic metaphor, if you've got that letter rack hanging in the house, you'd like to pop that in the MISC category then? Would you like that?
I would.
Yeah, miscellaneous. Okay.
Yes, I'd like that.
The character in Nicola is so very different from Helen in the book. It's based on a real friendship, I understand, that started for you, in your late 40s? You were in your late 40s?
Yeah.
That's unusual to start a deep and rich friendship at that point in your life, isn't it?
Well, I would have thought so, but I've moved around a lot over the last, not over long distances, but I've lived in Melbourne, I've lived in Sydney as a grown-up and a person of mature years. And when I moved to Sydney, which was, in the early 90s, I thought, well, I'm going to be homesick the whole time I'm here. I did have a couple of old friends already there that I'd known from previous years, but I thought I didn't think I'd make new friends. But in actual fact, I did. I made several, and one in particular. And I've found that there have been lots of times in my life when I've thought, well, for example, when I went to Newcastle, I got a job at the university in Newcastle in 2002, and I thought, well, this will just be a slog and I won't have any friends here and I'll be lonely, instead of which I actually made four really close friends who relationships that have deepened and become richer over the subsequent years. So,
well, it's nice to hear that because, Jerry Seinfeld once famously said, when you're a kid, you look out your window, you see a kid in a yellow shirt and you go, hey, I got a yellow shirt too, let's be friends. But in your 30s, you go to a party, you meet someone, you get on really well and you say, look, you're a nice person, we're getting on, we've got all these things in common, but I'm sorry, we're not hiring right now. Normally it is harder for people to make friends later in life.
Actually, somebody told me they saw somebody wearing a T-shirt once on which was printed the words, F off, I've got enough friends. And I laughed out loud, but I also was rather shocked. I think you'd have to be feeling very confident about your future to wear such a T-shirt.
That friendship, your friendship with Nicola in the book is based on, tell me what really allowed you to make such a strong friendship. What really was it that created that intimacy? Was it a week you spent together or time you spent together?
Well, I can date it to a specific moment. This person on whom the character of Nicola is based, she was a close friend, a good friend of my then husband, and he introduced us. And she asked me if I wanted to go to the movies. And I went along a bit anxiously thinking, I won't say what the movie was because somebody might feel wounded by this.
That's an Australian movie then.
Yeah, yes. It was. But so we went along to this movie and we sat there and we watched the movie and I thought, oh, this movie is terrible. I'm hating it. It's absolutely ghastly. And I kept looking at her sideways. She had this very pleasant, interested look on her face for the whole time of the movie. And I thought, if she likes this movie, there's no way we can be friends. And I went down a sort of a gurgler of horror. But at the end of it, as the credits came up, she turned to me with a smile on her face and said, that was the worst movie I've ever seen in my life. And from that moment, I had a great rush of affection for her and it never waned.
A mutual disdain for Australian cinema moment in your life.
Just that particular movie.
Yeah, at that time. In the book, Nicola is a bohemian and there's that really shocking moment in the book where she confesses she thinks she's led a worthless life. And Helen in the book seems quite shocked by that confession. That confession is, it is shocking to hear someone say that. Why does she say that? Why does she feel that way? She's been a bohemian and thus has led a worthless life.
Well, I think there's probably quite a few people walking around who if death approached them, if they were suddenly confronted by the prospect of imminent death, might feel a terrible despair like that. I suppose it's got to do with, I think some people who haven't had children sometimes might be a prey to that feeling. And by that I don't mean to, I'm at pains to say that I don't think that follows It's not a necessary outcome of not having children. I don't believe that everyone should have children. But
no, and in the book, Helen rushes to her side and says, "No, that's nonsense. You haven't led a worthless life. You have these people who love you, and
yes,
therefore, you've been fantastic."
But then people have secret hopes and dreams that they perhaps never express to anyone, and someone might be in their 60s and they look as if they're really quite harmoniously living their life, who's surrounded by friends who love them and have an affectionate nature, and they seem to be kind of quite deeply embedded into a social fabric where they seem content. But I think if someone says to you, okay, well, I'm sorry, but you're going to die soon, suddenly everything, it's like the life seen by the... At the moment that you're struck by lightning, everything suddenly becomes terribly vivid and harsh. I wonder if that might be what happened to this person.
Is there part of you that thinks that bohemian lifestyle is ultimately a selfish lifestyle?
Not necessarily, although talking about bohemians, I've just read Hazel Rowley's book about Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, which is based on their diaries and letters, the most extraordinary account of what I suppose you would call bohemian, although they were terribly hardworking. I think there's a lot of hardworking bohemians, but I think the character Nicola in the book expresses her... She looks back on her life and sees herself as having started off with certain advantages. She said, you know, I'm reasonable looking. I come from a family with money. I had an education. And she said, I had all this good luck and I pissed it up against the wall. I think that she felt she didn't achieve. Perhaps she had dreams of being an artist that she never fulfilled. It was a very painful moment in the book. And in the book, it's quite a shocking moment in the sense that the narrator, Helen, has an urge to comfort her, but there's something in her posture, in Nicola's posture, when she says, I've stuffed up my life, it's empty, I've failed. But she doesn't say this in a tone that's asking for pity or sympathy. She's sitting with a ramrod spine with tears pouring down her cheeks but looking dignified and separate, and it's very hard to know how to comfort a person who has reached a stage of appalled... perhaps truthfulness in their own approach to their own experience.
Well, this is it. This is the relationship you have with Nicola in this book. The two of you, she traps you all the time in a way by these things. I mean, nothing you can say at that time is going to comfort. She won't accept what you say, and she'll just take it as cheap consolation from you, won't she?
Yes, I think there are moments of truth in a life, or when I say moments of truth, I mean moments of kind of despair in a life where any sympathy can't even touch the sides. You know, you're lost out there in a place of despair, in a kind of abyss, and no one can approach you there.
Sometimes all you can do is just sit beside that person.
Yes, I think so.
Helen Garner is my guest. Her new book, her first novel in 15 years, is called The Spare Room. Nicola, in the book, comes to Melbourne to stay with you, to be treated by the Theodore Clinic, the Shonky Clinic. Is this based on a single place or like a whole lot of different places put together?
A lot of different places. I've heard a lot of hair-raising stories. I mean, as you get older, I'm in my 60s now, and as you get older and people get sick around you, people you know well, there's a lot of cancer, and people have their different ways of dealing with the terror of it. And many people I know have undertaken treatments that I am kind of appalled by in a way that's not really... I mean, my appalled feeling often isn't backed up by real scientific knowledge. I think also that these two women are... They're, in a sense, they're, well, I was going to say survivors of the 70s, but back in the 70s, we all had crazy ideas about... We were all very gung-ho against the Western medical establishment, but we were strong and healthy back then. You know, we didn't have anything wrong with us, so we just had a sore back or we had herpes or something like that, but you know, we didn't have cancer that was going to kill us. So
Yes, I was going to say, nonetheless, Nicola has a tumour that's basically intruding and replacing one of her vertebrae, and massive doses of vitamin C aren't going to help that and just going to make her...
But of course, she doesn't know that tumour is there. She knows she's got cancer, but she's trying to maintain a kind of revved up optimism, which she thinks is going to help her heal from the cancer. But it's only after the Helen narrator, the drags her back into the Western medical system looking for painkillers, because the Shonky Clinic doesn't offer any pain relief, that she's sent by the GP to a specialist who says, OK, we're going to do a scan. And that's how they find out why the real reason for her pain is, as you say, a horrible tumour which is encroaching on her spine.
Reading this part, I felt really pretty unalloyed hatred for this clinic and the people who practice these things. But I can see, as you're writing in the book, you're trying to contain that hatred. You're trying to go, well, actually, I must keep an open mind about these things. I must keep it. That's a bit 70s and hippie-ish of you, Helen Garner, isn't it?
I suppose it is. Although, every now and then you hear stories of miraculous recovery. And I actually... Well, for example, in the book I quote a line from a movie by a British film director called Sally Potter. It's a movie called Yes. And the two characters go to see this movie at a crucial point in the story in the book. And so I needed to write to Sally Potter to get her permission to quote these two lines in the text. So I did. I had actually met her once, so I emailed her and said, look, I've written this book and it's about blah, 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 and I summed up the topic of the book, and I said, I wonder if you'd give me permission just to quote the last two lines of your movie. And she wrote back and said, yes, of course you can quote them. She said, but my experience with alternative cancer treatments is very different from yours. She then described how her partner had been diagnosed with some horrendous cancer that was galloping through his body, and they spent several years on all sorts of alternative treatments in every part of the world. She didn't exactly specify, but I'm thinking, you know, Philippines, where they sort of invisibly cut organs out of you. And but anyway, so she said, and now he's been in remission for 5 years. And so, you know, that took the wind out of my sails a bit. Because every time you sort of make a remark of trumpeting certainty about cancer, someone will pull you up short with a story that you don't know. That you don't know how to categorise.
Nonetheless, this is an ongoing theme throughout the book. Mm. Helen Garner about to blow her top with rage, and then another voice in your head saying, "Settle down. Mm. That's not quite. Just don't leap to conclusions." But I'm so angry. I'm so angry.
Mm. Well, it is a horrible thing to witness a weak and vulnerable and suffering person in the grip of someone that you think is a charlatan. It's a horrible sight. It's always horrible to see a gullible person being taken advantage of, and it's a really horrible sight.
I like it when you finally take her along to see a real doctor, and the real doctor shoots glances at you like you're complicit in this nonsense.
Yeah.
And this feeling you have of going, but I don't know what I'm up against. You don't know, I never did this. I'm with you.
I'm sensible.
Yeah. Did you actually ever blurt that out? Did you ever go, I'm sensible?
Never. No. But all that rage that's in the book, there's a lot of anger in the book, and I think that part of that is what makes it's possible to laugh at the book sometimes. But see, that's one reason why I called the main character, the narrating character, Helen. Initially, I called her something else. She had when I was writing the book, I called her, I don't know, Carol or something. But as I worked on in the book and as it became the feelings that this character was going through became more sort of brutal and uglier, I thought, well, those are things that I've felt. I've been through those stages myself of helpless rage and fantasies of terrible violence, and I was terribly shocked at myself because I always had this idea of myself as being, you know, good in a crisis. And that's what you see with this character, Helen, the narrator. When her friend says, can I come and stay for 3 weeks? She has no idea how badly, in what a bad state Nicola is, but she imagines herself in a rather Florence Nightingale role, sort of rustling about with bringing clean sheets and making everything beautiful and being good in a crisis. She says, I am competent. I will get a reputation for competence. So there's this sort of vanity in her attitude to what she thinks she's capable of.
But the problem is Nicola won't accept she's dying. Mm. That's really the centre of it. She won't accept it.
Mm. In a terribly unconvincing way. I mean, she talks like this. She says, "Oh, look, by the middle of next week, the Theodore Clinic will have this cancer on the run, and I'll be fit as a fiddle." She's talking like
scooping
that.
Out cancer cells from me, as we. Yes, that's
well,
what
that's what
says.
The people at the clinic actually say to her. She says, "What does the ozone? There's an ozone treatment which involves sitting in a kind of up to your neck in a sort of like those old what they used to put ladies in weight loss clinics in the 50s in that they had in cartoons in the New Yorker with your head sticking out the top and sweat pouring down. But inside there, there's a sort of an ozone vapor." And the characters sort of holding an electrode in each hand and sort of ludicrous, weird treatments of that sort. But she thinks they're going to work.
She thinks they're going to work. And there's advice there from someone who says that sometimes people just go to their deaths right up to the last second thinking that they'll beat it.
Yeah. Well, the person who says that is a palliative care nurse. And I have enormous respect for the palliative workers. I think they're on a par with midwives, and they're obviously the flip side of midwifery in a sense. It's people who usher you into the world and those who usher you out. They're mostly women, but not all. And I've had dealings with them over the last few years because quite a few people in my life have died in the last 5 or 6 years. Both my parents have died, and one of my sisters and a couple of other very close friends have died. And in many of those cases, I've been involved in the care of the dying person. And so I've had dealings with the palliative people, and I'm filled with amazement and admiration at their skill and at this extremely honed psychological sophistication, the way that they can deal with people, not just the dying person, but the people around who are in terrible distress and confusion and filled with feelings they don't understand and which they're afraid to express because they're so ugly. But these people have got an extraordinary calm about them, a practical calm. I remember when my sister was dying, and she died at home, and we cared for her, a big family, and we could summon up the numbers to care because you need to have shifts. You have to be relieved if you work. But the palliative care worker came in on the last night of her life, and she was pretty well in a coma by that time. And the palliative nurse just said to us in a quite practical way, she'll die tonight. And she did. And I've never forgotten that. There was an enormous comfort in the fact that someone could just come in and say, it's over for her, it's over. So she didn't say, get ready. She just said, she'll die tonight.
I've never been to that place where to care for someone who's dying, not yet anyway.
Yeah.
You've done this four times with your parents, your sister, and this friend. What is that like to go into, do you, in getting ready to go into that world of caring for a dying person? I imagine it's like sort of getting ready to go into some very dark valley or something, or a dark place, and you have to
get
yourself out for it.
Well, it's not what you expect. In all the four people that I've helped to look after, they approached their deaths very differently. My mother didn't even know she was dying. You know, she was demented, and that was horrible in a particular kind of way. My father was quite cheerful, and yeah, that was another story. But it's not grim, you know. It's not, as long as the person's not in pain and if they're not suffering in ways that can't be relieved, and I haven't really experienced that except with my mother because of the Alzheimer's. But
you know, you're coming to a point though when that person is going to no longer be in this world, and there'll be a lifeless body at the end of it.
But you're not thinking of that, you see, because it, like everything else in life, you know, if you dread something before it's there, you can miss all the little stages of calm and beauty that might be there, and the sort of enriching moments. There are moments of laughter and sweetness and just moments when you can. It's the epigraph of this book is a line from an Elizabeth Jolly novel where she says, it is a privilege to prepare the place where someone else will sleep. And I always took that, you know, when I first read it, it was really just about bed making and housework, I thought. But then as I got older and 20 years passed and I started to understand these things more, I realised that she was talking about death as well. Just the place where someone's going to leave. But there's a sort of the labour of it, that's the easy part.
Getting up three times in the night, changing sweat-soaked sheets or urine-soaked sheets?
When I say easy, I mean you can do it because it's just physical labour. The hard part in the sort of relationship that I'm describing in this book, the hard part is being in bad faith with the dying person so that she is pretending she's not dying and you know that she's dying, and so it puts you at odds with each other, and there's this awful scraping of the nerves that happens. Whereas with my sister, when she died, she accepted that she was going to die. And she was really, she had actually been quite a prickly and difficult person. But there was some sort of sweetening of her nature that happened as she approached death. And we just used to lie around on the bed. I'd go and lie on the bed next to her, and we'd knit for a while until she got too weak. And then we'd just lie around talking, and sometimes we'd go to sleep. And other times we'd just talk about the past and laugh about things, and it's a very stripped back. There's no artifice.
And that's the problem with Nicola in the book. She won't strip back.
Yeah.
She won't.
Yeah.
She's hanging on to this mask. She doesn't even believe it, though, does she really?
No.
She doesn't really believe she's going to get better.
No, because there are points in the story where, for example, the person who runs the clinic actually drives her home to Helen's house one day, and Helen and the so-called professor have there's a sort of a horrible clash. She tries to object and tackle him, but
it's great. In fact, almost kind of hoping Helen will physically attack this person.
Yes, well, it is kind of tempting.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Great Australian writer Helen Garner is my guest. She's written her first book of fiction in 15 years called The Spare Room. We were talking about that part in the book where Helen confronts this Professor Theodore, he calls himself, isn't he? In fact, he's a vet, isn't he, in the book? With rage because of his mistreatment. And just tell me a bit more about that moment there and what Helen is thinking and feeling then.
She's obviously, he's quite skilled at copping flack, because this Helen the narrator can't be the first person who's said, "What are you doing? What are you doing to this person?" She comes home sweating and speechless and in terrible pain, and why aren't you looking after her properly? So he just tosses aside her complaints. But so she realises that she hasn't got the wherewithal to argue, and she's too angry to argue. And so there's a horrible scene. The next morning, she's in the kitchen, and Nicola comes out and greets her with a tuneful greeting. And that's where the shit hits the fan in the novel, in a sense, really, that Helen just at that moment is so full of rage that she just can't hold back anymore. And there's a terrible explosion. And she shouts and rants. And Nicola weeps. And it's a terribly painful confrontation between them. But,
and in the middle of it, Helen is saying, "Where does all this anger come from?"
Yes. Yeah, well, that's another question. I'll get back to that in a minute. But then when they had this terrible explosion and she reduces Nicola to a kind of gibbering wreck, then that's when Nicola says, "I have wasted my life." Then she spews up the reason why she's refusing to acknowledge that she's going to die. And then Helen and another person who's present in the room are able to express their love and admiration for her and to somehow calm this self-hatred that she's tormenting herself with. And then there's this little scene where it's as if a fresh breeze has blown through the house and it's blown away all this sort of this stink of falseness and bad faith that there was between them. And just for a moment, they all sit together in a row on the back veranda in the sun and they just talk like ordinary people, and they meet each other's eyes. There's this kind of blessed moment of calm in a book which is really full of terrible sort of psychological struggle. And Nicola and Helen are able to look each other in the eyes directly as they always have, and they can lean their shoulders against each other and they can say, "Would you like a cup of tea, or will we buy some fish for dinner? What will we do today? What a lovely morning." There's a kind of cessation of the struggle. And But it's as if Nicola can't sustain that state.
Now, that's I was worried about the book at that point. I was thinking, is this one of those awful Hollywood turning points where truth comes in, the mask is dropped and everything's fine? Because it just wouldn't be believable, because people don't change in a moment. They don't. They just, that's not how the world works. And it pretty quickly she goes back to believing in this this therapy that's not helping her at all.
It's a kind of coating that comes back. Mm-hmm. It's as if it's been ripped off her, and just for a moment, the truth is there, and they're all kind of hovering in that moment of truth, but then it can't be sustained. And I forget the point I was going
to
make.
Well, I want to get back to the anger issue here, because you do own up to less noble feelings in it. One of the things which I thought was funny, actually, some people find it alarming in the book, but I thought it was funny, is when you're fantasizing having her in the car with you, you fantasize about crashing the car, have her killed, but you walk away unharmed. That's not very noble. But it's kind of good to get these thoughts, these horrible thoughts out in the open where we can laugh at them, isn't it?
Oh, God, I think so. And as I was writing...
This is the thought and feeling you have for a friend who's dying of cancer at this time.
It's one of a huge range of thoughts that you might have. But when you said, you know, you were worried about the book at that point, that's exactly... that touches on something important about the book to me, and that was part of the struggle of writing it, that there's an enormous pressure to sentimentalise a story like this. And even if you've lived through it a couple of times and you know that sentimentality doesn't belong there, when you're writing this book, it's as if there's a sort of a form hovering behind you which is going, hey, and now soften it. And I had to fight that. I had to fight it every inch of the way not to let it go mushy and put a golden glow on it, and to keep on kind of chiseling off the sort of barnacles of sentimentality that were clustering around it. It was very hard to do.
Is this why you've committed to having the main character called Helen? Is that an act of committing to the truthfulness of what happened?
Yes, very much so. And not just truthfulness, but I want to know. I can't believe I'm the only person who's ever had these feelings, and I wanted to express them and put them into some form where they could be sort of put out there and to see how people will respond. I want to know. I don't believe that I'm the only person who's felt this horrible anger and fantasies of murder and violence.
I'm laughing at this. It's a horrible situation, but there I am laughing. And there are funny moments that you go and see that when you talk about it, you go to see the film. I'm just going to quote the book to you here, where, "Ah, Helen," said Nicola as we sped back along Punt Road, "that film was dropped into our laps by some god or other. I'd like to write the director a fan letter, and this very night I'm going to give myself a coffee enema."
You were supposed to laugh there.
Oh, God, okay. During this whole process, you do seem to find relief in domestic routine, changing the sheets, making tea, making a simple, nutritious dinner, those things as well. Mm. Have you always found comfort in that, Helen?
Oh, yeah. Yes, very much so. I quite like washing up. I do live in a house by myself, so there aren't enormous mounds of it, but I like those. There are domestic tasks that are very soothing because they're a simple, easy way of creating order. And I think there's a scene in the book where Nicola refuses Helen's suggestion that they should get the palliative care people to, you know, get themselves on the palliative list so that if there's a crisis at night, the girls can come around and help them out with the pain relief. But Nicola won't have a bar of it. But and she says, "I don't want a nurse. I don't need a nurse." And of course, Helen has been nursing her night and day for the last week. And so, she tries to control this rage, and she's got this bundle of sheets, and she kicks them across the floor and kicks them into the laundry. And she says in the book, "I stood out there for 10 minutes to among the equipment for imposing order, meaning the ironing board and the washing machine and things like that." But there are parts of the house whose purpose is to impose order, and laundries and kitchens are those. And I find them very attractive places. And I like sheets. I like folded things. And they it's a symbolic way of just calming yourself.
You must be a popular house guest then, around people's houses. Do you?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I go to other people's houses, yeah. I try to restrain it because it can look a bit, you know, a bit sort of nana-like.
Yeah. I think one of the unspoken things in the book, I don't know if this is intentional or not, is about, you know, what is woman's work in this? Yeah. And the act of caring for the dying is something that I suppose is not always but often done by women.
Mm.
Do you think that, I'm getting into hairy territory here, I know, but do you think it's something women tend to find it easier to do, to care for the dying? Are women stronger at that, do you think?
Well, look, women are used to mess and blood and guts. Even women who haven't had children, because having children is the great introduction to chaos and mess, and to dealing with, you know, bodily fluids and things that of that nature that are sort of smelly and awful. Well, I don't know many women who can't deal with that. The only people I know who find, you know, for example, baby's shit so repulsive that they couldn't change a nappy. It's as if women have got to get real about the body and the material world and its kind of unattractive aspects, whereas it is possible for men to avoid that, really.
And about dying, too. I mean, my mother for many years worked in a geriatric hospital as a nurse, and I was shocked to discover one day, you know, I think I just asked the question when I was a teenager, you know, she talked about some old dear who died the other day. I said, what did you say to her? Do you talk to them? Going, oh, yes. You know, she just cheerfully and inverted. And I said, what do you say? And she told me what she says to them, and it was lovely and beautiful. I said, where do you get that from? How do you do that? I mean, I don't understand how that took strength and kindness and she seemed to do it effortlessly as well. Mm. Whereas if it was like, go in there and talk to that dying person, if that was put to me, I don't know what I'd say. I'd find the thing traumatic and stressful and I wouldn't say the right thing.
That's very fascinating. It is. I think that the gist of it is just being able to sort of be with someone. The idea that you have to say something to them might be the scary part. If you can just go and be near someone, sometimes that person will let you know what they need. I can't help thinking a lot of this must go back to motherhood and the experience of just being with children, because children live very vividly in their emotions. I've got these three little grandchildren now, and it really reminds me of that every day, how passionately they live each moment. And when they're sobbing and crying because they weren't allowed to have a chocolate frog or something, that's real. It's a real emotion. It's not put on. And their troubles are terribly vivid and tend to be very sort of fast-moving. They change a lot. And you learn how to be with them. And you learn that saying things isn't always what's required. That's an interesting question. I hadn't really given that much thought. It must be pretty annoying, I imagine, for women to feel that those jobs, they're fated to do those jobs.
They're left for women to do. They're the mess that no one else will clean up.
Yeah, well, I think that's pretty well the case domestically. The women are the ones who do the muckiest jobs because they're the ones that notice that they need to be done. Well, I mean, obviously there are heaps of guys. I'm very impressed, actually, by the way that men of my daughter's generation, for example, her husband, have a very different attitude towards all these things from the attitude that men of my generation had. Just watching my son-in-law dealing with his kids, he's just so relaxed about it and so not... He so doesn't feel that it's beneath him or that it's somehow... you know, that he's just holding the fort till his wife gets home. It doesn't seem to be that way. And it's really quite moving to me to see that. I love to see that.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Conversations. Broadcast. Podcast and online.
Helen Garner is my guest. Her new book is called The Spare Room. Helen, you mentioned before you've cared for your parents as they were dying, a sister and this friend that Nicola is based on. We do have different ways of dying. Was each way different, or could you break it down into two different basic categories? Could you say there is a way of dying where you accept what's going to happen and the way of dying where you don't accept what's going to happen to you?
Well, I can say that I've... my sister accepted that she was going to die, and that made her philosophical and calm. And well, she didn't want to die. She had new grandchildren. She was sad to die, but she accepted it, and it was quite a remarkable experience to be with her. And my friend, on whom Nicola is based, fought it right up to the end. And that was terrible in many ways. But then so that's the extremes in a sense. But then you've got people like my dad who, on the morning that he died, he was 91. He was still living at home next door to me, but he didn't look too good. He said he couldn't get his breath. And I looked at him and I thought, I think I'll call an ambulance. So I called an ambulance and these two guys came in and they said, they put him on a gurney. So they said, we'll take you into hospital. And they put him on this gurney and they were trundling him out the door. And I heard one of them say, now, Mr. Ford, have you ever had any heart problems? And my father sort of bellowed as he was being carried out the door. He said, there's nothing wrong with my heart. Nothing whatsoever. And he died that night of congestive cardiac failure or whatever it was that he had. And I just happened to be the one person out of our enormous family. I was the one who happened to be with him in the room when he died. And he was... They actually took him in and intubated him and everything, because he came over all bad in the ambulance. But we were all standing around, all my family, there's a huge family, we were all standing in a ring and they were saying, well, we're going to pull out his breathing tube now because we've got to give him the chance, but we'll see how he goes. So we were all crying and saying goodbye, Dad. And they pulled out the breathing tube and he went and took an enormous breath and everybody just burst out laughing. The doctors and nurses and all of us burst out laughing. And so then they took him upstairs and admitted him. And I just happened to be the one, 7 hours later, who was in the room when he breathed his last. And to me, it was just, he was unconscious. But I was so, it was such a wonderful thing. Because my dad and I had fought all our lives. Until, I suppose, about the last 5 years. And we'd had a bit of fighting. But I'd realised in the last 2 years of his life that I really did, not only did I love him, but I actually liked him. And I found him hilarious. We used to laugh all the time and listen to music and go out for coffee. And just to have been there when he died, and I felt that there was this wonderful peace. Just he took a breath and then he didn't take the next breath. And there was a nurse actually pulling the sheet up and arranging the sheet, and she was leaning right over him, and she had her face was right near his face, and I was on the other side of the room, and I heard his breathing stop, and I said, he's gone. And she kind of stood up and looked at him, and she said, oh, he has, he's gone. And then she just quietly left the room. And I thought, oh, it's over. This huge... relationship, an enormous relationship in my life. But it was, I felt so blessed and calm. So everybody doesn't have to fight their way out. Some people will fight right to the end, and other people just, there's a breath, and then you wait, and there's not another breath, and they're gone. It's the strangest thing.
I love the fact he died while he was being tucked in.
Yes, I did too. He was being comforted and cared for by a pretty nurse, not that he could see her.
Helen, there's a passage in the book which seems to be, I don't know, the central theme of the book, or the central idea of the book, when Helen or you were dealing with Nicola's refusal to accept that she's going to die. And I'll just quote the book here. You say, a chain of thoughts go clanking through my mind like the first dropping of an anchor. Death will not be denied. To try is grandiose. It drives madness into the soul. It leeches out virtue. It injects poison into friendship and makes a mockery of love. That's really what the book's about, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I think it is. And I suppose when you state it like that, if a person read that paragraph just out of the context of the book, it could sound awfully kind of dictatorial.
Sounds like something from the New Testament, actually.
I wish. But That's what I think. And it's stated very, very brusquely at that point in the story. And I think that really, as you say, it is the theme of the book, that you can't deny death, you must take account of it. But there are many different ways of taking account of it. I think that remark comes at the end of a scene where Nicola is talking to a third person about her relationship with Helen at the house where Helen, she says, oh, Helen's a wonderfully severe matron and I do have this treatment that does leave me feeling a little bit ragged, but, you know, I know we're not going to have to call the palliative people. We've only set it up so poor old Hel won't have a hard night, so she won't be scared at night. And she turns and looks at the narrator and laughs, and it's something like a melodious gust of mocking laughter. And at that moment you realise that the book is, in a sense, also a tremendous power struggle between the two women.
Yes.
As to what attitude to death
that's the
will
truth
prevail.
Of it. It's a power struggle.
Yeah.
It's a power struggle, and you sort of have moments where you get on top of it, but Nicola sort of pretty, well, she, I don't know if she wins it, but she doesn't lose it, does she?
No, she exactly. And she's quite wily. She's very good at, she divides and rules.
Yeah, there's a at the scene at the end of the book, and I don't want to give too much away, but at the end there's a tone. The tone changes at the end where Helen's had enough. And the tone is kind of detached, much more detached. And I got the sense that at that point your friend exhausted her credit at the bank of Helen Garner and exhausted the friendship at the end. Exhausted the friendship. She needed so much from you.
Yeah. Yes, but when she returned to Sydney, to where she could have a whole lot of people looking after and not just the poor old Hel.
Poor old Hel.
Mm. Yeah. Then it became possible again for Helen to reapproach her, and for the last few months of Nicola's life for them to have some kind of tenderness between them again, because Helen's shift had ended, as it were. And I think what was wrong with Helen was that she was looking after a dying person 24/7. She got no rest. She was crazy with sleep deprivation and rage and all the things that were happening. There was no relief for her. But I think there's a lot of guilt too in the end there. You know, then that last sentence where it says, I handed her over.
Yes, and there's guilt there, and there's still a lot of anger.
Yeah.
And I don't know, do you, given that it is so closely based on what she went through, have you forgiven your friend for what she put you through?
Oh, yes. Oh, with all my heart. I mean, I miss her every day, and she was a wonderful, wonderful friend to me. And that's why it was so shocking to have felt these brutal feelings. But, I mean, I feel quite sure that, that if she knew about this book, she would delight in it. She was a person of great robustness, and before she came to the state that she ended in, she was a person of enormous generosity and enormous ability to see her own faults and mistakes and to criticise herself. She was, I feel very glad about having known her.
She's probably more, I mean, I get the sense you were very different. You're very different women, a lot more gregarious than you.
Mm.
And you got, it sounds like you got a lot out of that. With a great, charismatic, gregarious person, you can sometimes follow in their slipstream and have a really good time. Is
That's
that what she
true.
Was like?
Yeah, she was wonderful. I adored her. And we just laughed. We used to laugh together till we were just weeping with laughter. And there's not so many friends that you, as you go on in life and the sad things happen, that that's true about. She was a wonderful person. Flaky as hell, but a beautiful character, a wonderful soul.
And it's clear in the book that the reason why she came to stay with you, even though she wouldn't accept that she was going to die and she was doing this therapy, it's pretty clear, and it's great the way that Helen gets advice, that she came to stay with you because she needed someone to tell her that.
Yeah, I think so.
Tell her that she was going to die and that the treatment wasn't going to work.
Yeah, I think on some level of her, so she had so many friends whose beliefs were, you know, in my terms, as flaky as hers, but she chose to come to me, and I've always, you know, I've puzzled over that, and I've concluded that she wanted a severe matron, and that's what she got.
Helen, it's been great speaking with you today.
Thanks.
It's been
very
really
much,
enjoyable.
Richard, thank you.
Helen's book, if you are just inquiring, is called The Spare Room.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.